There's so much more to Asia than just Bali, although maybe you wouldn't know it from talking to some of your friends. There's more to Asia than Copenhagen too, there's more to it than Vietnam. This is a huge, varied and fascinating continent, a landmass that stretches from Vladivostok in the east to Istanbul in the west. And yet many travellers are only just scraping the surface. Hi, I'm Ben Groundwater and you're listening to Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast. Today we're taking you to Asia, but not just any part of Asia. We're delving into the undiscovered and the unknown, the underrated and the unheard of. We're going on a journey to parts that may sound a little dodgy, maybe a little scary, and probably a little weird, but which will seriously reward anyone game enough to give them a go. In the first half of today's episode, we'll discuss a few countries you might never have even considered visiting. And in the second half, we're going to delve a little deeper into some of our favourite Asian destinations to see what it's like once you get off the beaten track. And of course, I'm going to need help doing this. My first guest on the panel today is a traveller.com.au writer who's been to Asia more times, I'm sure, than she can count, Uta Yonker.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, Uta. Great having you on board. And also joining us on the panel, we have Intrepid Travel's regional product manager for Asia, Tara Kennaway.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, Tara. Now, Tara, as Intrepid's Asia boss, you must have seen quite a lot of the continent, is that right?
I have, and been to some destinations multiple times too.
Yeah, right. When did you first start travelling to Asia?
I actually started travelling before working for Intrepid. Mm-hmm. My first main experience of Asia was going to China and teaching English there.
Oh, right. Okay. Now, whereabouts was that?
For some reason, probably being young and naive, I thought I'd pick somewhere in China which I'd never heard of before, which could have been anywhere outside right. of Beijing or Shanghai. And so I chose to go to the city of Mudanzhang, which is in Heilongjiang province, about 5 hours away from the Russian border.
Wow. Whoa. And that was your first experience in Asia?
And that was pretty much my first experience of Asia, apart from a stopover in Malaysia once
wow.
before.
What was that like?
Odd.
Yeah.
challenging. Amazing.
We're talking undiscovered Asia. We're straight into it.
That's... Absolutely. Yes. Really out there as a destination. It's not a place that anyone would really go to without a good reason, I think. It's a coal mining area mm-hmm. and a bit of a transit point on the railway on the way to Harbin, which is yeah. the main destination people go to in that part of China. And there was probably only about 5 foreigners in the whole city of 1 million people, which is a small city for China.
Yeah, wow. Mm. And was there a moment of culture shock for you when you got there?
So many moments. So many moments. For a start, it was winter.
Oh, wow.
And it gets really cold there. Like, we're talking minus 20, minus 30. So it was winter when I arrived, didn't speak any Chinese mm-hmm. and didn't really know too much about the school where I was going to be teaching or much about the town either. So there was, yeah, everything surprised me.
Wow. Would you ever recommend people go there for a holiday?
If you would like to go somewhere where the main attraction is the underground shopping mall underneath the town square or the hill that people walk up for exercise in the morning, then go ahead.
I'm going to take that as a no.
But yeah, amazing. I mean, as the English teacher of the college that I was at, I had my students taking me everywhere. I got invited to weddings, to church, bizarrely,
right.
and all kinds of places. So it was really fascinating.
Now, Uta, Asia, we talk about Asia, it's a huge swathe of the world, isn't it?
Oh, it's this massive landmass. And I think as Australians, when we think Asia, we think Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being really surprised probably in the 80s in London when I heard someone talk about, oh, his friend who was Asian, and I'm sitting there looking and going, no, he's Indian.
I was going to mention yeah. that too. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's, I think wherever you are, the part of Asia that is closest to you is what defines Asia to you. And we often tend to forget the rest of it.
Yeah. I mean, to us, I guess Asia is Southeast Asia. It's Thailand and Vietnam and maybe China as well. But, I mean, it drives me crazy when you hear people say, I've done Asia.
Oh, for God's sake.
Travellers who say, I've done
Asia.
Pet peeve. Because it's just so big and there's so much there to do. I mean, even the Middle East officially is part of Asia, right?
That's it.
And yeah. it's even within countries. I mean, we've talked about China, which is, if you think about it, that's a continent-sized country, if you know what I mean. There's such diversity in there. But even in smaller countries like Japan and Korea, you can go to different parts of the country and have very different experiences. So it's, yeah, okay, you've been to one city in you know, half a dozen different countries. Yeah. You haven't done the continent.
India, every state could be a country very easily.
Yes, the diversity
different
is absolutely
language, different
astonishing.
Food, different people.
Different religions.
Mm-hmm. See, and when you look at the map of India, there's even those parts that aren't even really connected to the to the rest of the country, which are still India, like Nagaland and amazing places with fascinating names like that. So, yeah, done Asia? Not sure.
Yeah. Tara, have you already always found it easy to get off the beaten track in Asian countries?
I've always wanted to. I think that's something that I always want to do. I mean, I want to see the main sights of places for sure, because there's a reason why those tourist attractions are popular, you know, Forbidden City and Great Wall and that kind of stuff, if we're talking about China, for example. But I want to see what else there is as well. And, you know, I want to see those places that touch the edge of the country where it meets another. And I want to cross the borders into the next place and just see how one culture merges into another. That's the kind of stuff that really fascinates me about Asia.
Yeah, right. How about you, Uta? Is overland travel, is that the way to get off the beaten track?
Oh, overland travel can be totally amazing. I did a trip once because it was just the only way I could work out to get there in pre-internet days, overland from Vietnam into the far west, southwest of China. Mm-hmm. And just watching this amazing scenery change was fantastic. But it doesn't even have to be remote. I went to Japan and I wanted to go to Shikoku to see the hanging bridges. And the only really possible thing was to have an overnight stop in Okayama. So I thought, well, I'll have a look around Okayama, which I've never heard of, which is sort of halfway between Kyoto and Hiroshima. So it's not remote. But it was this fantastic city that had these amazing historic gardens, and it had a little water town 15 minutes from the central station, and it had its own history with the Lucky Peach myth. And it was this really interesting place that just is kind of nowheresville and yet fascinating.
And took absolutely no effort at all to get to. Yeah. I found that in northern Thailand as well. You know, you think of Thailand as the beaches and the islands and Bangkok, and everyone goes to places like Laos and Cambodia for that rural kind of off the beaten track experience.
Yeah.
But all you have to do is start to travel north in Thailand. And if you aren't in Chiang Mai or Chiang Rai, basically you're just in the middle of nowhere.
And you have these, I mean, Isan province has these amazing Khmer temples, which are equivalent to anything you'd see in Cambodia, and no visitors. You know, there's a lot to be seen once you just go a little bit sideways.
Yeah, for sure. You're listening to Flight of Fancy. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can find stories by our guests and other great writers at traveller.com.au. Now, Tara, one of the areas of Asia I've always been fascinated with and have never got to go to yet is the stands.
Oh,
and
stands.
I know you've knocked off a few stands
in
your
time. I love the stands.
Yeah.
Central Asia is absolutely my favourite part of the world.
Why is that?
I just find it fascinating that there's such a huge part of the world that so few people know about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in the middle. It's in between Asia and Europe. You've got great empires of the past that have crossed there and been part of developing the culture that exists there today, but yet so few visitors.
Right. What are the people like there? Do they consider themselves Asian? Do they consider themselves part of Europe? Or?
I've never asked them,
right.
So I'm not sure. Look, I think they consider themselves Asian and consider themselves not even necessarily from that country, because there's a lot of ethnicities even within countries there. So people identify a lot with their ethnicity. So they might be Uzbek but living in Kyrgyzstan, for example.
Okay.
But being Uzbek will mean more to them than, you know, saluting the Kyrgyz flag.
Right, okay. So Chinggis Khan went through there.
Chinggis Khan, you've got Persian influences, especially in countries like Uzbekistan, very similar architecture to what you can see in Iran. You've got all different kinds of nomadic tribes. You've got Turkish influences. As you get further east, you've got the Uyghur people who also cross into China as well. And then the most recent influence, of course, is the USSR and the Soviet Union. So you've got the impact of that on those countries, which are now, you know, recently independent from the USSR.
So when we say stands, we're talking Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan. There's a few more as well. Pakistan.
My favourite is Tajikistan.
Right. So why is that?
What is
in Tajikistan?
It always
seemed like a bit of a
mythical place to me, because, you know, who knows what's in Tajikistan, right? And a number of friends and I who are good travel buddies, we always had this joke about see you in Tajikistan, because it just seemed like somewhere we'd never get to.
Right.
And then we made it happen. Mm-hmm. In 2014, the three of us met in Tajikistan.
Wow.
And we'd all travelled around some other stands before, and in Russia and China, Mongolia, so neighbouring countries. But Tajikistan was the most fascinating landscape I've ever seen in my life, because you've got the Pamir mountain ranges and you've got the Wakhan corridor, which goes along the border with Afghanistan. So basically you're driving on one side of the road, and that's Tajikistan, mm-hmm. and across the river is Afghanistan.
Right.
So that was just fascinating, just driving through the Pamirs and staying in little villages and the most incredible mountains, you know, really austere, severe kind of landscapes. And then you get down into a little valley and it's all fertile and people are growing veggies in their gardens and flowers everywhere and amazing hospitality as well. So it's a road trip.
Yeah,
a real road trip.
Okay, my question.
Yes.
Which is always the same question. What's the food like?
The food.
Good question.
Well, I would say that no one travels to Central Asia for the food. It kind of fascinated me because you'd go to markets, especially in Uzbekistan, and you'd see all these amazing spices and things. And then I'd think, where are they on my plate? You know, what are they doing with this? So, look, the food there.
I mean, it's the Silk Road, isn't it? It was a spice,
yes,
sort of.
Yes, that's right.
Area.
So
yeah.
you still see them, but they make rare appearances, I think, right. in food. So it's heavily mutton and wheat based. Mm-hmm. So you have lots of different meat dishes, soups and barbecue and things like that, noodles. They do eat rice as well. But the best thing, I think, is the bread. Because they have this fantastic tandoor oven kind
right.
of baked bread.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
everywhere you go has their own different style.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can't differentiate from one village to the next.
But
they can.
Right,
they absolutely
okay.
can. And everyone will tell you that, you know, the bread is the best bread.
Yeah. I remember reading a travel story a few years ago, it was a while back, when the movie Borat came out. And, you know, basically that whole thing was making fun of Kazakhstan and Kazakhs. And so this journalist went to Kazakhstan to kind of dispel all the myths in Borat, and found that it was actually not that far from the truth in some place.
Yeah, I remember being on a train in Kazakhstan, and I swear the guy was, you know, Borat's cousin, really. And even some of the phrases that he was saying were very, very close to Borat's catchphrases. But then again, those countries, they're massive. Some of them are huge. You know, Kazakhstan is one of the biggest countries in the world.
Yeah.
And while there's a lot of empty spaces in the country where people aren't living, there's also such diversity there. And people who live in the main cities are going to be completely different from the people who live nomadic lives in the countryside, or who were exiled there years and years ago by Stalin, you know, and kind of ended up settling in that region. So the diversity is fascinating too.
Yeah. What's the travel experience like there? Is it pretty rough and ready? Do you have to be...
In some ways, yes. You need to be prepared for long travel days, not the best roads in a lot of places. But then again, Uzbekistan has high-speed rail now.
Right.
So between...
Get
I know, right? And we can't
Are you listening,
even...
Australia?
Do you know how long it took me to get to Sydney this morning from Melbourne? And that was a plane. So, yeah, between Tashkent, Samarkand and Bukhara, high-speed rail, 2 hours.
Wow.
Super fast modern trains. So I think you always find the unexpected. I know that when we travel to Asia, quite often we think that we're more developed than the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
China's more developed than we are. Japan, much more so. And countries like Uzbekistan, you get there and you're like, huh, we've got a lot to learn. You
yeah,
know,
right.
we could do some things here.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. Flight of Fancy is brought to you by Intrepid Travel. From Vietnam to Bhutan, Intrepid visits more than 29 countries across Asia and over 100 countries around the world. So wherever it is you want to go, chances are there's an Intrepid trip for you. Intrepid tours include a great balance of inclusions and free time, unmissable highlights, and local secrets you won't find in any guidebook. And of course, loads of authentic real-life experiences. Intrepid's trip leaders are born and raised in country, so they know their destination better than anyone. With Intrepid, you won't just see a place, you'll live it. Small groups, big adventures. Visit intrepidtravel.com to find out more. Uta, I guess one thing that's interesting to me is that the Middle East is part of Asia. It's, you know...
Absolutely.
It's not something that we normally think about as being Asian, but it's there. It's part of it.
And it's got so many great destinations.
Right.
I mean, you know, sadly, one of my favourite Syria's, not so much these days, but Jordan, Iran, Israel, there are amazing places to explore. And it just doesn't seem to feature much in our travel plans at all.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I'm actually really not sure. I think people don't understand the diversity. They think it's a very uniform place. And it is true. I did once spend 3 months in the Middle East, and I have to say I probably didn't eat falafel for a year after I got home. But there is the histories and cultures. It's a bit, you're talking about the stands, and it's all part of the thing. These are the routes through which the great empires of the past trafficked.
That's it. Yeah.
You
yes.
know, ideas yep. and goods and architectural styles. And they're just fascinating places to explore.
Yeah. And again, in the same way as we do with the stands, we have a certain idea of what these places are like. But once you get there, you find that that's completely different.
And again, like you were saying, in terms of that it's very tribal and, you know, they're like, I'm an Uzbek. It's if you go to Iran, don't even think about mentioning Arabs because they're not Arabs.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Okay, they're Persian.
Yeah.
They're different. Mm-hmm. They speak Farsi, not Arabic, and they will not take that kindly.
Yeah, and they learn English in school before they learn Arabic.
Yeah.
If they're going to learn a second language, it's English.
That's it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which has been so incredible to find out when you get there.
And I think that's the other thing. We often overestimate the difficulties of communication. It's not... Okay, Iran has a very good education system, and a lot of people speak
yes.
English there. And the older ones don't, but they usually speak French. So if you've got that, you can get by. But in other countries, it may not be that everyone speaks English, but everyone knows someone who speaks English.
That's it. Yeah. And they'll find them.
Yeah,
they'll call them.
Yeah. Brother, that's or it. They hand you the mobile phone and go, here.
That's it. Yeah, you do get that, don't you?
And that's the thing I think that's interesting. Both Asia and the Middle East, the cultures are so much about hospitality. And that's one of the linkages, if you like, across the whole continent.
Mm.
And it's a beautiful travel experience if you open yourself up to it.
Yeah. Totally agree.
Yeah. Now, one of the countries I wanted to talk about is Korea, which it doesn't sound like it's off the beaten track because we know so much about it, South Korea at least, but it's actually not a place that many people go to. Everyone sort of is obsessed with Japan, and you kind of, little old Korea just sort of gets left behind.
And they've got great food.
They have amazing food, yeah, and they've got, I mean, I was there very recently and I sort of felt a little bit sorry for them because everything they were showing me was kind of like, just like, a little bit like Japan, and it reminded me of Japan, but it wasn't as big and as well known as Japan. And I was like, you guys have got some great stuff going on here.
I think that's the struggle, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I've worked with Korea for a while, and it is really hard to encourage people to go to Korea.
Yeah.
Because for that very reason, you know, what can I see there that I can't see in Japan or in China? And when you just try to say, well, Korean things, which is really the main difference,
yeah.
It's difficult to understand what that is, but everybody who goes there loves it.
Yeah.
And the food is definitely, Uta, the food is definitely the highlight. And I think now people are starting to understand what Korean food is. There's more Korean food in Australia,
that's
for
true.
Example.
Yeah.
So people are then going, oh, if it's good here, imagine how good it is in Korea and going there for that. I mean, I know there's like a kimchi festival, for example, which, you know, yay, kimchi.
Who doesn't love kimchi?
That's it.
And then I think that even once you break down the barrier of getting to a destination, so there are, I think people are increasingly aware that Seoul is a place you can go to, and that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. But I love Busan, which is the second city in Korea, and I actually prefer it to Seoul. I think it is such a cool place, and it's, how are you going to convince someone to go there?
Yeah, it's tough. No one knows anything about Busan.
Yeah.
It's got amazing seafood markets. It's a beach city. There's, you know.
It's got a fantastic contemporary art scene. It's a lovely city to be in. It's got a lot of things to do. And the people are so surprised when foreigners show up.
Really,
why are you here? But that's one of the draw cards too, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's the
Korea's
joy of it.
Korea's an easy place to get around. Public transport is amazing. Yeah, again, the railway network or even the public buses.
Yeah.
Incredible landscapes as well. Like, everyone loves going hiking in Korea because there's so many
in
amazing national...
In perfectly matching leisure wear.
This is true. So maybe, you know, think about that before you head out.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a lot to see and do in Korea, but to make people go there as a destination in its own right, I'm not sure what it's going to take to convince them.
Yeah, I don't know. There's some great cultural quirks there as well. Like, I don't know if you guys have heard about couple clothing, but this is a thing that Koreans do where to show to the world that you're in love and you're with your partner, you wear exactly the same clothes.
I love this.
And there are stores that specialize in these clothes where you can have the same jeans, same top, same jacket. Or I saw this one couple with one half of a love heart on his t-shirt.
Oh, those are my
favorite. And the other half of a love heart on her t-shirt. And they're walking around with no shame whatsoever.
I love those. And there's ones that, you know, the sentence starts on one t-shirt and finishes on the other.
Exactly.
Or it's like a a cartoon that continues across.
Yep.
So, I mean, I know that Korea is really popular for other Asian travellers to mm-hmm. visit. We're talking about the Middle East before. A lot of Middle Eastern travellers go to Korea for shopping, for cosmetics, for cosmetic surgery.
Oh, this is mm-hmm. the other thing. Korea has some of the best cosmetics in the world, especially if you've got sensitive skin or that
they
sort
do.
Of thing. I had a friend who just went berserk there buying up stuff. So, and it's cheap.
And also, little traveller tip, if you go into any cosmetic shop, you get lots of free samples. They just give you face masks and tissues and creams and you can try them all out.
I didn't find that for some reason. I don't know what it was.
Not sure.
Yeah, there's not much beard oil.
You weren't with someone with a matching outfit.
Exactly.
That was the
problem. Yeah. No one to impress. Now, Tara, another country, we've actually talked about this on Flight of Fancy before, is Mongolia, which we've talked about it not being maybe the easiest place to live, but incredible place to visit.
Oh, my goodness. Mongolia, I think I've never been somewhere where the people have such a connection with the land and with animals. Even people who have now moved to the capital city, to Ulaanbaatar, they still have this yearning for the countryside. And, you know, and a Mongolian doesn't seem happier than when they're on horseback, you know, like really just something just seems to light up when you see local people with their animals and out in the countryside. So yeah, fascinating place, and one where visiting it now, you can really start to see a big cultural shift. There's a lot of mining in the mm-hmm. country now, which is really changing the economy, but also you know, a lot of people are being removed from their traditional lands, and also economically they've had a hard time since the collapse of the Soviet Union, where Russia used to support Mongolia a lot, even though it wasn't part of the USSR. And so a lot more people are moving to the cities, and you kind of see this clash of cultures. You know, you see these Gur suburbs where people are living in their traditional yurts, their tents, on the outskirts of the city, but it just doesn't quite seem right that they're in a big city and still having that lifestyle that's more suited for the steppe.
And they're all grouped too closely together they would be otherwise.
Yeah. So it's really interesting.
I just found there are very few places in the world where you can experience a traditional lifestyle that is not being put on for tourists. Mongolia is one of those places. Like, if you go out to stay in a ger in the countryside, that is the way people live, and there is nothing put on about that at all. This is traditional nomadic lifestyle, which is still happening.
Right down to the food. Sorry to sound obsessed.
Coming back to the food. Yep, Mongolians don't eat vegetables traditionally, probably because they couldn't really grow them in the soil. But even now, modern Mongolians, a lot of them feel that vegetables are bad for you.
It always makes me laugh when people, when you mention going to Mongolia, and people say, oh, cool, like Mongolian barbecue. You're like, no. Mongolian food in the Western world bears absolutely no relation to Mongolian food in Mongolia.
I think a Mongolian barbecue in Mongolia is a marmot cooked in the coals.
Yeah. And they say that they mature the meat on the animal, meaning that they just let the animal keep on living until it's literally about to keel over, and then it's time to...
Well, until then you need it,
right? Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's born of necessity, isn't it?
Yeah. So even that's interesting in itself, you know, that relationship to food. You know, so much is from milk products or meat, and while, you know, that is from the animals that they then have raised to eat, they still have such a loving relationship with their animals. They don't name them, but they take good care of them.
Yeah.
So they're so important for their livelihoods.
Yeah, and some stunning landscape there as well in Mongolia. It's just incredible. This Himalayan steppe with just no trees and just goes on and on and on forever. It's beautiful.
Yeah, what do they call it? Land without fences or
right.
something like
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Oh, and almost no roads as
That's
well.
It.
Like when people need to move from one place to another, they just drive across the land. They don't bother with a road because there really aren't any.
Yeah. Yeah,
they
amazing.
Just need to know where they're going. Cars turn up from nowhere. I'm like, wow, okay, well done. but now, guys, Asia, it means, as we were saying, it's the subcontinent. It's India, which surely that's... Uta, do you think it's an easy place to get off the beaten track there?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you feel like you're off the beaten track the minute you walk off the plane, I suppose.
And... it's, you know, when we think about the places we consider to be the must visits in India, it's half a dozen places, and most of them tend to be grouped quite closely
right.
together in that northeast.
Rajasthan, yes. Varanasi, Mumbai.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's so try something different. Go down to Kerala, completely different feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, go up to the mountains of Ladakh, again, completely different feeling. It is these ancient cultures that have... The country of India is actually quite a modern creation, you know. So you have one country, but you have dozens, if not hundreds, of different cultures located within there. So take yourself just about anywhere and you're going to have a really interesting experience.
Yeah. Where do you recommend there, Tara?
I have a fascination with Gujarat.
Okay.
I haven't been there yet, but I really, really want to. Yep. They have the last population of Asiatic lions in the world there.
Now, this is a state, it's between Mumbai and Delhi.
Yeah, that's right. Gujarati food is meant to be incredible. Mm-hmm. Amazing thalis, so all the different smorgasbord of dishes all on one tray. And there's a lot of really spectacular looking Jain temples there as well, kind of perched up on cliffs and, you know, so you've got to trek to get there. That's kind of what's capturing my imagination at the moment is a trip to Gujarat.
This is the other thing. There are so many ancient temples, ancient cities, ruins of all kinds scattered around this country that you'll sometimes be reading, okay, so what's nearby? And go, oh, 1,000-year-old city now abandoned from a civilization you've never even heard
of. That's it. There's just so much depth, isn't there?
Yeah.
That you could never explore at all. So I think, you know, picking a state or picking an area, like you were saying, Ladakh or Kerala or Gujarat, picking somewhere and just getting into it, you're going to discover so many things.
Yeah. Now, this brings us around to discovering, I guess, the sort of unheard of parts of countries that we know so well. Now, Uta, I know you spent a lot of time in Indonesia away from the Bali thing.
There are so many beautiful parts of Indonesia, and some are quite easy to get to. Go to Central Java, and that's so tranquil and lovely. But there are also some fantastic discoveries. Last time I was there, I sort of, the way it happened, I had some time to fill in, and I kind of went, and I just had to make a decision quickly, and I was like, Sulawesi. There's some interesting people in Sulawesi. I remember drawing the houses in school, and I just went, just take me there.
What school did you go to?
Asian Studies, Year 7. This is what we did. And the Toraja Highlands, oh, my goodness, one of the best things I've been. These people live very traditional lives, and they do have amazing wooden houses that are all painted, and the roofs are shaped, depending which anthropologist you believe, either like an upturned boat because they originally sailed from Vietnam and used their boats as their roofs, or like buffalo horns they're intensely focused on two things, one of which is buffalo and the other of which is death. And the two are linked. So because when someone dies, it's all about the funeral and you have to have a big funeral and you have to sacrifice at least 14 buffalo or, you know, if you really love someone, it's got to be at least 21.
Wow.
And buffalo are very expensive. And so you have to save up for the funeral. So that means that if granddad has died, you're going to basically wrap up granddad as a mummy and put him in the back room for 2 years until you've saved enough to buy the buffalo.
Those buffaloes must be really sweating on everyone's health, wouldn't they?
but the funnest part of it is that, you know, the way they get around these sort of taboos that would be around that in most cultures is granddad is not dead. Granddad is still sick.
Right.
So, Ben, if you come to visit me and you go, hey, how are you going? And go, oh, I'm good, but granddad's still sick. And so you'll pop into the back room and pay your respects to granddad and go, hey, granddad, how are you going? It's fantastic.
Wow. There you go.
And I mean, are they basically bankrupting themselves to follow this tradition?
This is the fascinating thing, because most tribal cultures that have held onto their traditions reject many modern things like, say, higher education.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Toraja. They're cluey. If you're a Toraja parent, your children know they have to become doctors, dentists, teachers, high-value professions, and they're expected to then go to what are considered hardship postings in Indonesia, somewhere like Borneo, so they earn extra money.
Right.
And then they send the money home so everyone can buy buffalo for the funerals.
Well, they've got it all worked out.
And we haven't even gotten onto the cliff graves and the cave graves. And when you get around to burying people, there's a whole bunch of other stuff. And you go to Toraja, and because this is such a part of their life, there's a funeral. You know, basically what the guides do is they ring each other up and go, who's died?
Is that right?
And, you know, these funerals go on for days and you just pop up and go, hello. And they go, welcome, come to our funeral. Come and watch the buffalo being sacrificed.
So they're happy to have people come along
and
watch?
They love it. Yeah. It is considered quite prestigious.
Right. And, you know, that's a world away from a backpacker barracuda, isn't it?
It's a different century. It's a different worldview. And it's relatively easy to access.
Right. So how do you get there?
You take a flight, and then it's a couple of hours. Okay, it's probably 4 or 5 hours in a car, but you know, it's easy to organise. It'll take you half a day to get there, but you're going several hundred years back in the past.
It's fascinating. Mm. Yeah.
What do you think, Tara? Where are some of the countries that people know well that you can get off the beaten track and still do some different things?
We talked about India already. China, I think.
Yeah.
It's massive.
Right. And as you were saying, Beijing and Shanghai and Xi'an, maybe those are the places people know.
Yeah, where else have people heard of, you know? So there's so many different ethnicities in China, and there's so many different cultures and different landscapes. So really, while I don't recommend Mudanzhang as a place to, you know, go, right, I'm going to go there, Guizhou province, areas of Sichuan and Gansu, where there's Tibetan areas that aren't the province of Tibet, so they're easier to access. Xinjiang in the far west, the biggest province. There's got to be something interesting there. There definitely is.
What about Yunnan, which is one of my favourites? Beautiful, fascinating.
Yunnan, I would totally recommend for the landscapes, and then for all the villages and towns you can visit that have still those elements of traditional culture and
very tribal, lots of different tribes. And it's the one part of China where Han Chinese is the second language. So the street signs, for instance, if it's a Dai majority area, the street signs will be written in Dai script with Han characters beneath it.
Right. Yeah, so
and it passes the Uta Yunka test of decent food there.
Oh,
as well,
my God, the food is so good.
You know, I don't know why there aren't more Yunnanese restaurants around the world, because Yunnan food, like even just mushrooms, right? Mushrooms is such an important part of their diet. They have like hundreds of different kinds of mushroom dishes, and you see them all being sold, all the mushrooms being sold on the side of the road, and you're like, what even is that, you know?
And let me tell you, they can make celery taste good, okay? Yeah. I have no higher praise than this. Also, best crispy bar snack in the world. Deep fried bamboo worms.
Really?
So tasty.
Coming to a pub near you.
And Yunnan also has cheese, which you don't think of Asia as a cheese destination.
Right, yeah.
But in some parts of Yunnan province, they have a traditional cheese that they make.
Right, so, right, I'm going back.
Go back. Go back.
Now, guys, just wrap up. I have one final question. I wanted to ask you, a bit of advice to people who want to go to Asia and they want to get off the beaten track, but maybe they're not sure how to do it safely, how to do it easily. Tara, what would you tell people to do?
I would pick a destination that you've got some interest in, whether it's from something you've read or a film you've seen, even if it seems like a country that lots of people go to, like Japan or China, Indonesia. But then when you get there, eat something you'd never imagine eating before.
Right.
Or something you've never heard of, or go to a restaurant where there's no English menu and just see what happens. And it might be a disaster, but there's a travel story for you, and it might be amazing as well, and there's another one.
That's getting off the beaten track in a very safe way, really, isn't
it?
Because you're still in this place that's heavily populated.
You know how to get back to your hotel, but you've just, you know, ventured
very
a
quickly,
little bit.
Possibly.
Yeah, a little bit outside your comfort zone, and who knows what you'll discover.
Yeah, great. And what about you, Uta?
Oh, I'm going to push you way outside your comfort zone.
Oh, yeah.
Choose a random method, throwing a dart, pulling names out of a hat, pick a country you know nothing about, and then research it, because the information's there. These days it's easier, and you will find there are great things to see and do. There may or may not be great things to eat, but you're going to have an adventure one way or another.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about you, Ben?
I would say to people, travel overland between these destinations that you know well, and just stop off somewhere. It's very similar to what you were saying in Japan, you know. Just try somewhere different, somewhere that people haven't really talked about too much before, but happens to be on the way to somewhere that you know you're going to love, and see what happens. And there's every chance that I think it'll turn out really well. So, guys, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. I think we've learned a lot. If you would like to read more of Uta's stories, you can check them out at traveller.com.au. And for some amazing travel experiences in Asia, check out intrepidtravel.com. So, Tara and Uta, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
And if you'd like to subscribe to the podcast, you can find us in iTunes or on your favourite podcasting app. You've been listening to Flight of Fancy, and we'll see you next time.